My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Burns.
Really appreciate being here. Elner and Marianne, thanks for asking me to come. It's always a privilege. Been doing this for a long time. It's interesting, I don't get scared anymore. I just get where I can't think. And I don't think that's really fear, because I do remember fear, and I still have fear, but I've never been this old, and my cognition's never been this bad. So it may be that that's what causes this. It's been a wonderful conference, and I do appreciate Carl. Thank you for picking me up, and I appreciate your kind words. I noticed you said you never had to eat turkey like that before. How much crow have you had to eat? If you follow the same path I did, it comes pretty frequently and still does. When I got the program delivered to me or was mailed to me, I looked at it and pretty impressed. I mean, regardless of what I say today, I'm really not a dog behind the microphone. And I looked at all the rest of those people and I thought, this is going to be a slam dunk. This is going to be fun. Because most of those people on there are heroes of mine and I of them. I'd not heard Mickey, and quite honestly, so far for me, the things that she has said were probably the most powerful things that I've heard here, so much so that I've asked her, and she's agreed to do it, to come to Louisville, because we have a 400 men and women's homeless shelter, and we sleep 250 men and women a night we have 250 of them in a year-long program of recovery using Joe McQueenie's Recovery Dynamics, where we teach the big book all day, and they go to meetings at night. And we have a number of women, probably close to, I guess, 75 to 100. And these are women who have lost hope. They have been on the streets. And when she told her story, there were a couple of times that it brought tears to my eyes because I've sat and talked with them. We're pretty much gender specific, except every now and then they think I'm old enough I can come in. I don't represent any threat to them. I don't represent any threat to me. You know, by the time I've thought about what I'm going to do, the conversation's over and I've gone home, you know. I really don't have a problem with my age, in spite of the fact I allude to it frequently throughout my day. I just never knew I'd get this old. I really never knew I'd get this stupid. But Mickey has agreed to come up and talk to those women because, boy, that's the kind of story that I need to hear just generally about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, but especially to be able to talk to those women who don't feel like you're able to tell them that you can do and feel. You know, they think they've really lost it. They don't think it'll come back. Some of them are started so young, they don't even know what it is to have it, you know. You've asked me to come and tell you a story. This is my journey. Each of you will have your journey. It's incredibly important, at least in my reflection, that you not compare your journey to my journey, either thinking it's better or thinking that it's worse. It's just a journey, and each individual will take it. We'll follow the same highway. Generally, we'll follow the same roadmap, but we're not going to stop and rest at exactly the same places. We're not going to have the revelation there. So it's an individual journey, and welcome it. If you're early in recovery, I can remember being so terrified that I didn't know what journey was. So it's an individual journey, but let me tell you something you better not forget. If my experience has meant anything, you must not take it alone. An alcoholic taking this journey alone is the wolves will get him, get her by the first intersection. Take your journey. Take your journey. Please take it, but don't take it alone. To say the first thing an alcoholic gets back when he quits drinking is his opinions. And in what I'm going to say, I like to call them conclusions based on experience, but they get damn close to opinions as I go through it. I'm able to be slicker in dressing them up. But I have drawn some pretty significant conclusions because with 27 years of recovery, my sobriety date's December the 1st, 1977. With 27 years of recovery, I've seen a lot because from the very first day I walked into this program, I have lived here. And this program is a great place to live. It's a terrible place to visit, you know. But I've lived here, and I mean I've lived here well. I've experienced the miracle. There were times I didn't know that was a miracle because I only saw the first part of the circle close. But many of the things that I have experienced, the circle did close, and I've seen the entire miracle. And it looked like crap on the front end, but it came out smelling like a rose on the back end. And so I'll try to share that with you. The other thing that I need to share is that there's no way. There was a time in my recovery career when I got on the Sawdust Trail and went around and talked and died on the criticisms and lived on the praise, that I thought I could articulate what this program means to me. Today, there's no way. I can do the best I can do to express and let you know what I've been through and the absolute joy that I have experienced and still do. But there's no way I can tell it all. It's not possible for me to tell it all. This program has given me, obviously, a design for living. It's enabled me to regain my dignity. And it's given me my family. My daughter is 44, and I thank you for this. My daughter is 44, and she's been in AA 24 years. My son is 39, and he's been in AA 22 years. And those children have never had to take a drink from the minute they walked in. And we now have a common language and an ability to communicate that I'm absolutely certain we wouldn't have had. My brother has been in AA 20 years. He's 8 years younger than me. I only had one brother and never had any sisters, but the book is if you're Brady and you're on your way to the bus stop and you pass a bar, you might as well go into an AA meeting because you're screwed from the time you pass that bar. Or frankly, you've been given the gift from the time you pass that bar. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol, no drugs. My mother's father died drinking bleach in the Mayfield City Jail in 1935. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield in 1935. When my granddaddy got drunk, they'd put him in jail. When he sobered up, they'd put him in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. My mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week in good weather, sweeping the Mayfield City streets in the Bible Belt of western Kentucky in the middle 30s. My mother dragged the whole disease of alcoholism into our home. The scarlet letter from Mama was not adultery, it was alcoholism. And as I say, I did not grow up in a home full of with alcohol, but I grew up in a home dominated by alcoholism. My mother's what's known as an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, if you have a problem with that concept, just go read the chapter of the family afterward. The first page, if you're around one of us, you get neurotic. And my mother was neurotic. Now, I need to clarify something for you. I adored my mother then. She died in 78, and I adore my mother today. I absolutely loved her to pieces. I think of her every single day. She loved me better than life itself, and I loved her. But my mother was a goofy lady. There wasn't any two ways about it. I learned from my mother gave me my first experience with conditional love. My mother lived through both of us children. If we were perfect, she smiled. Because that's the way she got back her dignity. That's the way she got her value. Because up until that time, right or wrong, she felt her value came from a man who died drinking bleach in the Mayfield City Jail. So she lived through us children. And I became perfect. I became perfect. I mean, I became so perfect the night I was laying in bed before I went to college. I looked up at the ceiling. I said, God, if I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me. I mean, no shit. I was that perfect a kid. Now, I learned to be that perfect because my deal was if I got perfect, I got Mama's approval. She patted my butt, parted my hair, washed my clothes, and made me feel like, as T-Boat said, king baby. And that's where it all began. Wilson wrote the second best thing, in my opinion, he ever wrote in 1953 when he wrote a letter called Emotional Sobriety, published in The Grapevine in 1958. And in that he said, after 18 years of sobriety, that he felt that all of his problems came from dependencies. Money, power, prestige, sex distilled them into approval. And I've worked with hundreds of alcoholics, and I've never seen a one that didn't start out with the agenda being to get some approval. It may be a slapping hell out of you, but you knew damn well that they were there, and they basically wanted somebody to say, you're okay. And it's deadly if that's how I live and how I die. And that's how I started, was seeking approval by being perfect. Thank God I'm in a program today that tells me on the front end, not only do you not have to be perfect, we're going to give you the rules and tools to help you deal with your imperfection and make it this a realistic life rather than that pie in the sky, constantly afraid, trying to be perfect to get the approval. The second place that I got conditional love was out of the church. Now, I need to tell you, I spent 12 years in church, rolled medals down my chest, and I'm grateful because in 1977, with a shotgun in my mouth, had it not been for the values of the church, I would have pulled the trigger. No question. When I came back from treatment, I sat with my sponsor and sat with my priest, and we talked about, I asked Jimmy, my priest, take me back to my church, and he said, Burns, I can do that. But he said, you've got to go to AA. You must go to AA. AA has better success with alcoholics than we do. But I can take you back to your church. So I spent 8.5 years, my first 8.5 years, going to 7 meetings a week and administering the chalice and the host, and was a lay reader in the Episcopal Church. At 8.5 years, I sat down again with my priest and my sponsor, and we prayed about what would be my ministry. Because I'm absolutely convinced, this is my opinion, for me for sure, and I think for you. If you stick in this program, you got a ministry. You can call it whatever you want to call it, but as this story unfolds, the ministry is well defined. The word is not used, but there is a ministry. And they both told me my ministry would be in AA. I was ready to go to seminary. I'd have gone. Being a doctor, I would have become a medical missionary, and God knows what I might have done. Saved the whales, the drunk whales, for all I know. But I mean, I would have done it. I would have done it if they told me that they felt the best they could see this was God's will. They said, no, Burns, your expertise, your commitment to, your passion for this Alcoholics Anonymous program in recovery, your ministry will be in AA. But the church was the second place I learned conditional love. What they said was, this isn't what I thought they said. This is what they said. You believe this or we'll fry your ass. I mean, that's what they said. You know, I mean, they didn't mince any words. That's what they said. I'm not saying your church said that. I'm saying my church said that. Now, I'm 12 years old the first time I get this message and doing what 12-year-olds do. And I remember one message that just rocked me to the core of my being when it said it's better to spill your seeds in the belly of a whore than on the ground. And at 12 years of age, I just found a new pull toy and I'm having a hell of a time figuring out what to do. I mean, I sinned every day of the week and then went down on Sunday and confessed. I mean, that's what it was. And they'd baptized me on Sunday night. Hell, I've been baptized more than most of you had a glass of water. I mean, that was it. But I got this message, you're abnormal. You're no good. Blah, blah, blah. That's what it was. So I had conditional love from the church, conflicts with the church. Before I was ever old enough to even know what the doctrine or the theology of the church was, I was in conflict, wanting to get the approval and be perfect. Now, this didn't make me an alcoholic. Wilson said in More About Alcoholism, the real alcoholic is bodily and mentally different. Now, I spent 25 years practicing family medicine. I've spent the last 17 years practicing addiction medicine. I have a great deal of credibility on both sides of the fence, in the medical profession on this side. Most of it is my experience and what I've read and learned about what we know about this disease. And I got to tell you, I can put the formulas on this wall to show you that we're born to quart low. Now, there are all kinds of medical terms. Let me tell you something else that's really fascinating. When Wilson wrote the big book, he and Silkworth actually told us everything about this disease in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Women will drink differently from men. Young people will drink differently from old people. This is a physical allergy and a mental obsession. Hell, now we got all these neurotransmitters and receptor sites and reuptake blockade. But it's the same damn story. All over. And the more I read that book, the more I become fascinated by the depth and profundity and simplicity of this piece of literature. I mean, I'm not going to tell you I'm a genius. I'm not going to tell you I'm well-read, but I'm sharp in a damn tack. Mine's chaotic to hell. I'm not saying I'm brilliant. I'm just weird. I'm just mind going all the time. You know? If it's there, read it. If you don't understand it, read the son of a bitch again. And then if you don't understand it, turn it upside down and read it again. You know? But what gives me the credibility is when they say, well, how is this manifested? Let me tell you what it was like laying on my back in the police station trying to find me a drink. Oh, okay, so that's what you call about as an obsession. Right, that's an obsession, you know. Yes, sir, we were born to court low. We drink and we get normal. We keep drinking and we go right down the crapper. Because the brain is changing itself to meet the threat that's happening from the drugs or the alcohol. And I need to tell you something else. If you're like me and want to try to get perfect, you can't get perfect enough to drink again or use other drugs again. It ain't going to happen. It is not possible with the current level of our science, as Wilson said in the big book, and the current level of our science today does not have the answer to make us drink successfully again. Oh boy, they're still trying to find it. And who knows? It won't make a hell of a lot of difference to me. And I pray to God that it doesn't stop anybody in their journey to find the very, very, very core of what each of us is seeking when we come in here. Some way to feel safe. Some way to feel like we fit in a world that's so, so threatening. So the silver bullet isn't going to do the job. Not for me. And I would imagine everybody in this room today is very much like me. The party was last night, and you came to church this morning. Some people didn't for one reason or another. Some people didn't. I loved the party, and I love going to church on Sunday. Bodily and mentally different. Alcohol. Now, let me say this. What I did know, the old timers used to say to me, when you come in here and stop the drinking, if you don't deal with the thinking, you go back to the drinking. Well, my thinking started way back. I hit the delivery room floor thinking crossways. My thinking is crossways, and my thinking came from right back there. Fear, resentment, need for perfection. That's where the thinking came from. And if you're in AA, and you're like me, if you don't deal with the thinking, you go back to the drinking. It's that simple. And it ain't going to feed the baby just to go to 7 meetings a day. It ain't going to hurt. Unless, of course, you're getting ready to go to the poorhouse, your family's not eating because you're in 7 meetings a day. Then you got a problem knowing what the hell responsibility is all about. But just going to 7 meetings a day ain't going to feed the baby to deal with that thinking. Meetings, at least for me, are to hear people say what they do between meetings. To be able to live in a world where the price of gas is too damn high. You know? And how I deal with that. Alcohol and drugs were no problem for me in high school. In college, there was a little bit of a problem. My first semester, my freshman year, I was the first Brady who ever went to college. And started drinking beer like a lot of freshmen do. And found out I had a weird propensity that when I drank beer, I'd go serenade the women with the rest of the guys. And I'd take off my clothes and sing Buck Naked. Nobody else got naked. I'm not sure. I don't know what I was so damn proud of, but at the same time, I also found out since there were no invitations for a date, none of them were too proud of what I was trying to do either. But the dean noticed, and the dean called me in. You're a nice kid when you don't, you make good grades. You're a really smart young man. But when you drink, you act weird because you get naked, so you got to quit drinking. And if you still get naked, you got to go home. So I quit drinking, quit getting naked, and we had a ball game. And I stayed there, and I graduated. Went to medical school in 1958, University of Louisville. This part of my story is about drugs. I'm a card-carrying, commode-hugging, a quart of whiskey a night, 12-gauge shotgun-in-the-mouth alcoholic. And you'll see that. But this part of my story is about drugs. I've listened to a whole stack full of fifth steps. And if anyone's following the formula, they don't really vary that much. They really don't vary that much. But almost in every individual that I've ever listened to, there's a piece of that story, and I think, that's the one God wants you to say, at least as I see it. That's the piece that seems to be, if not unique, at least relatively rare. Well, my story, I'll tell you about one drug, amphetamine, that I took for 12 years and nearly destroyed me. I didn't drink. And then I'll tell you about the drinking for the next 8 years where no other drugs damn near destroyed me. The seminal message is, if you're an alcoholic of my type, no mood-altering drug will act in you like a normal person. If you quit drinking, think you can smoke a little dope, and you're an alcoholic of my type, you're screwed. If you quit drinking and think you can do a little coke, or you're doing coke, and you quit and you're going to do a little drinking, the whole deal, it ain't going to work. Now, I can sit here once again and explain to you the neuropharmacology and the neuroanatomy of the brain. I can tell you what it's like to live it. I can tell you what it's been when I've had multiple medical problems. Heart problems, kidney problems, the whole deal. I mean, I look incredibly good to have had all the physical problems that I've had. But the fact is, somebody said, "Why, damn, Burns, you've had a lot of problems. You look good." And I said, "Oh, God asked me if I wanted to feel good or look good. And as a drunk, which one do you think I took?" Yeah. I remember one time I'd been back from treatment about 3 months, and I woke up in the middle of the night and I knew I had a kidney stone. Man, I knew exactly what it was. And I grabbed Casey. We took off to my wife, we started taking off to the hospital. The stone had quit moving and I was just aching. And I said, whatever we do, Casey, don't let them give me any pain medicine. Because, my God, I'll be struck drunk on the way home, you know, like we teach each other. And I'm glad we do. We need to be aware of that. Man, I was there and I was praying and she was driving. I ran to the emergency room. I knew the doctor and he said, "Burns, you got a kidney stone." I said, "Yeah, about that time it started moving." That son of a bitch started moving. "Give me some Demerol. Give me some morphine. I got to shoot something up my butt. Whatever you got to do, stop this shit, you know?" But I got to tell you, like any other alcoholic, when I started coming off of it, I was goofier than a goat. So we've got a mechanism that we do when we have to take medicine like that. We put you live with your sponsor. The wife feeds you. You don't go to the bathroom by yourself for about 2 weeks. And you go to a meeting every time not on the phone. You know, I mean, that's the way it is. We just watch each other. Now, my job is to help teach the doctors about that. And we're doing a little better. Not as good as we will do, but a hell of a lot better than we used to do in most areas. We've got a long, long way to go, but we're getting better. Started taking amphetamine. I didn't take it to get high. The upperclassman brought it down to me when I studied my first gross anatomy exam. And I was just terrified, felt like I was tired, I wasn't going to be able to stay awake. He said, "Take this, it'll help you stay awake." We all take it, and they all did. I took that amphetamine, and in less than 2 months, I was absolutely addicted to it. I mean, I took it all through my medical school career. I got kicked out of medical school 2 weeks before graduation in 1962. In an amphetamine rage, I hit one of my professors. They put me down to sent me to the dean and the head of the department of psychiatry. I told them I had a drug problem. They put me in intensive psychiatric therapy for 2 years. I didn't take any drugs. I didn't drink. Psychiatry helped me. Psychiatry was the first place that taught me that anger is not a primary feeling. It's a result of resentment and fear. They taught me that in 1964. I didn't really make it a part of the recovery process till I got to y'all in 77. They taught me a bunch of crap. They taught me I lusted after my mother. And I remember thinking, "Man, you think I'm weird? You're one weird dude, you know?" I mean, it was so weird it didn't even threaten me, you know? But 2 years psychiatric therapy. After 6 months, I detoxed from that stuff, and I was ready to go, and I read my books, and I reread my notes, and I walked back into medical school ready to go, hell bent for leather, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and in less than an hour, I strung out on amphetamine again. And I sat on the steps of the medical school and cried because I didn't know what was wrong with me. Now, you know what's wrong with me, and you know why I couldn't stay clean. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. AA has never been afraid of knowledge. And in good recovery, none of us are afraid of knowledge. But knowledge, as the book says, won't keep me sober. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. They did not bring me the spiritual solution. And if you read their contract, they're not telling us we're going to. Therapy will never, ever, for an alcoholic of my type, be sufficient to stay clean and sober. I still have a therapist 27 years later. I've been in therapy with my wife. But we both took incredible 12-step programs into therapy with a therapist who understood the only way we knew to solve a problem was the 12-step solution. And they brought us the message, and we individually and together used the 12 steps and the fellowship and our sponsors to come to peace with each other and to come to peace with what we had learned in therapy. One of the things that concerns me the most today is that too many therapists or recovering AA people who think that therapy is just teaching people how to use the 12 steps. And of all the faults that people that may be there, that's the least one. But the other is the therapist who believes that they have the answer just by telling us what's wrong with us and showing me and us about the conditional love and about my mama and about my daddy. And I got to tell you, it contributed, as I've shared with you, right up to here. But learning about that didn't keep me from being crazy. Got back out of, went to medical school, got screwed up in a very short period of time, continued to take amphetamines. My classmates enabled me. I graduated from medical school, went into my internship and residency, interrupted it four times, strapped down IV fluids, straight jackets, padded cells. I might stay off of it 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. Always went back, always made me crazy, put me in the mental hospital. I got out and started my practice in 67, decided I was pissed off at the Vietnam War, and so I joined the Army. Went down and joined the Army for 2 years. Hell, that was the only solution I knew. I've straightened this shit out. You know, if I can just get in there, we'll get this war over. You understand? Now, if anybody had said that's what I was thinking, I'd hit him in the mouth. But that's exactly what I was doing. I'm going to straighten these dumbasses out, you know. So I went in the Army office, got put in Leavenworth for taking amphetamine. Came home in 1969 and got back on amphetamine because post commander took me off of it for a year and told me he's going to put me in Leavenworth if I didn't quit. So once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. So I came on home, got back on the amphetamine, gallbladder attack. The surgeon and my internist, we sat in the hospital and held hands and prayed. They'd all gone to school with me. We knew each other. And they thought it was partially due to the amphetamine. They took out my gallbladder, and we prayed that I'd not take any more amphetamine. That was in 1969. That was my last amphetamine. Now, I'm sure the prayers had a lot to do with it because I have seen the miracle close once again a number of years later. But I know at that time what really did feed the baby was I started drinking. First 4 years, wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't think about it every minute. I didn't get up planning to drink. I got drunk a lot, but I didn't think about whether I was going to get drunk or stay sober. Next 3 years was pure alcoholic. I didn't drink anymore, didn't get drunk as often, but I knew exactly when my first drink was going to be. It was going to be at 4:30. I had a very successful practice, one partner. At 4 o'clock, I walked out. I went to the 7-Eleven, got me a quart of beer, put it between my legs, drove home, went in and got my drink of choice, which was scotch and water. And then I would get smooth. Y'all remember smooth? I'm going to tell you something. You damn well remember smooth because you're in this room to be able to remember the rest of it. Right? But you know when you're in that perfect place, even now the devil coming dressed in his best clothes will help us remember smooth. The book says there will come a day and we've been able to bring to our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We forget. It's called state conditioned learning scientifically. But the alcoholic forgets because the devil wants us, if you have a problem with theological terms, I'll call it evil. You can call it whatever the hell you want to call it. Wants us to go back to be not irritable, restless, and discontented, and to feel at peace in this world where nothing works. Last year, my drinking was addictive. I drank a quart of whiskey a night. Told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. I had to believe it. I had to believe it. Can you believe that an individual who at least is industrious enough and probably bright enough to go through medical school and do all that training could absolutely be deluded to that point? Well, of course we can. It's the evolution of the peculiar mental twist to get us to a point to where we can do the deadly because we don't know how to live with what we got to live with. And it doesn't happen overnight. My first wife kicked me out of the house in 1975. Should have kicked me out sooner. Our marriage was made in hell. She didn't like me. I didn't like her. But she's the first woman I ever had sex with. And my religion said if you have sex with a woman, you're supposed to marry her. Her religion said if you have sex with a man, you're supposed to marry him. We really hated each other, but we got married because we had had sex. And I'm not sure that rule, if it's properly worked with, is a decent rule. It's interesting when you read in the fifth chapter, fourth step about sex. It's really about relationships, but Wilson knew if he wrote down, "We're going to talk about relationships," nobody would have read the damn thing. But said, "We're going to talk about sex." I wonder if there are any pictures in this book, you know? But we spent 17 years together, had the two beautiful children. Finally, with enough alcohol in me, and I was not promiscuous. But with enough alcohol in me, I was just such a horse's ass that she kicked me out of the house. I put her in a position where she had no choice. And that was exactly what I was trying to and didn't even know it. Trying to do and didn't even know it. So she kicked me out, and I womanized and ran for about 2 years. I really thought I was cool. I bought me a white Corvette, and I wore a powder blue leisure suit with a white turtleneck. I mean, I was one cool SOV. I've seen pictures of that, and honest to God, I'm so ashamed of them. Man, I had a quart of, I had a case of Chivas Regal Scotch in the trunk of my Corvette, and a sterling silver mint julep cup. Okay, so you can see me in this light blue leisure suit with a quart of scotch by the neck and my sterling silver coming in out of my white Corvette, looking good. The man is here. We were doing karaoke, at least I was, long before we could even spell it. Oh, God, what a chapter in my life. I wouldn't forget that sucker for nothing. It's just that, I mean, even today, I think that's funny stuff, you know. But I thought I was cool. And then I met Casey, who's now my wife and probably one of the finest human beings God ever made. I mean, absolutely wonderful. Casey's 13 years younger than I am. She'd watched her daddy, who had bipolar disease. She watched her mother take care of him. I watched my daddy take care of my mother, so we had a fit like Velcro. I took care of her. She took care of me. Fortunately, we had good hearts, or we would have never made the chicken salad out of the chicken crap we started with, but that's the way it was. And, oh, God, what a wonderful relationship. We drank together, drink for drink. We rolled high, and then I got real sick. I started getting sick. You know when it starts. I started getting sick. End of my drinking, I would get up at 11 o'clock. I didn't want to go to sleep because I thought if I go to sleep, I'll wake up. If I wake up, the day will start. So if I just don't go to sleep, the day won't start. Now, you know how faulty that thinking is, but that's just where we are at that time. So I would sit in the chair, and Casey would come in and say, "Please come to bed, Burns." And I'd say, "Get away from me, Casey. I'm going to drive you crazy like I'm driving everybody else crazy. I'm crazy. Get away from me." And I'd sit there and drink my quart of scotch whiskey. I played my two absolutely omnipresent, ubiquitous records that we all have. Whatever records were your records, each of us have our records. Yeah. Mine was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And the other was Neil Diamond's "I Am." I've thought back about my great hero at that time was a man who's talking to a frigging chair, you know. But, I mean, that was my hero. And I'd play those records and drink my scotch and then get up at 11 and take a Valium to quit shaking and drive to the office and see patients in 2 hours. It took me 8 or 9 when I, before and then after I quit drinking. I'd run over to make my hospital rounds in the evening so the real doctors wouldn't see me. Because I knew I wasn't a doctor anymore. I was a technician at best. I'd always considered and still do consider it a real privilege and honor to be a physician. Ranks up with the privilege and honor I feel that I'm an alcoholic. Because each of them are really a wonderful place to be. They just are. If you don't feel that way about your alcoholism and you need to be with us, stay with us, and there will come a day when you will honestly get on your knees and thank God that you're an alcoholic. Because that individual journey I'm talking with you about will bring things to you, if my experience means anything, and the people who have spoken to us before means anything, and many of you in this audience that with 40 years plus sobriety can say, what a gift. What a gift. But I knew I'd become a technician. I wasn't taking a doctor into the exam room. Now, when I came back with my partner, we reviewed all of my records for 5 years, and I practiced technically competent medicine. It would have passed any quality assurance review, and did. But for at least a year in here, I knew that I was no longer a doctor. If you wanted to come in, I could examine your heart, your lungs, your throat, do all the things that we do, and had no problem. I was well trained. But you want to talk about your pregnant daughter or your mom and daddy going in a nursing home or something like that? I couldn't do that. I could not process that because I was too busy moving to quit withdrawing. That night, that morning, Casey had gone to work, and I'm sitting in a chair, and I knew it was over. There will be some people in this room who will really understand that. You know when it's over. You don't know shit about what to do about it, but you know it's over. And I sat in that chair, and I knew it was over. And in retrospect, and it's been alluded to from this podium, I had finally crossed lines with people. I'm talking about hurting the people I love so often and so bad that I couldn't live with that. I couldn't live with me being a compromise of what I thought I was supposed to be. But the thing that broke me was when I realized I cannot continue to hurt the people who love me. And if you touched me, you bled. You got cut. It wasn't that I called you an SOB or that I didn't. It's just I lived a life where you didn't exist and was not a part of it. No matter how bad you wanted to be, my children, my mother, my daddy, my patients, they couldn't be a part of my life. And I didn't reject them on purpose. I could not do any better. And I knew it was over. I said, God, you got to help me. And immediately I knew what to do. This is where it gets to be a real individual journey. I said, God, you got to help me. And I knew immediately what I had to do. And I went in and got my 12-gauge shotgun and put it in my mouth. And I was going to blow the back of my head out because I was ready to go home. Because I believed deeply in God. God looked like Charlton Heston and lived on a cloud. And I knew as soon as I pulled that trigger, I would go home and there would be peace. There would be peace. And that's what I wanted. I just wanted peace. I sat on that bed and I thought, Mama and Daddy would be better off without me. Casey would be better off without me. My patients would be better off without me. And I got to my children. Now, I was not a Norman Rockwell father. Even today, I'm not really. I tell you what I am. I'm a Norman Rockwell grandfather. I'm a damn good grandfather. Because at the end of 2 hours, I get to go home. And for 2 hours, I can hold it between the curves, you know, and do an incredible. It's not, I mean, I love them. It's not at 2 hours that I quit loving them. It's at 2 hours I can't catch them anymore. So it's time to go home. I was not a Norman Rockwell father, but I had been in practice 8 years, and I'd seen a number of people come in impaled on their spear of what had they done wrong that a loved one killed him or herself. Why did Mom and Daddy leave? Why did brother leave? But I'd watched them as adults struggling with what they had done wrong that so-and-so killed himself. And I knew I could not leave my children wondering, why didn't Daddy love us? What did we do wrong? Now, at that moment of complete self-absorption, because I can tell you, having been there, I know what suicide is for me, and I'm pretty sure I know what it is for most people. At that moment of complete self-absorption, that's not a pejorative term. At that moment of complete self-absorption, which means that while God exists, I have the power. I had to get something done to get God's approval. I would pray to God for relief, but felt that the only way to get relief was to work through what I could do. None of this was conscious. Suicide is when we hold the power and the power fails and there is no option. At that moment of complete self-absorption, and I reflected on this some years later, my God had me think of another human being, my children. What I've learned in this program is it's not about me. It's about my getting ready for you when you get ready to come to us. Our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. Eighth and ninth step. If you haven't been through that book enough, go find it. Our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. It doesn't say to be of maximum service. It says to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. And if you're trying to be a sponsor and you haven't done your step work, or you don't have a sponsor and you don't have a home group, then you can't be a sponsor. You can drive the car to pick them up and take them to a meeting. But you try to sponsor them and you haven't done that work, you haven't fit yourself. I know I spent 10 years on the 3 1/3 step, and I'll get to that in a minute, and I was sponsoring more people than I could count, and I was dragging more people off to treatment than I do today, and I do it a lot today. So I know what it's like to carry the disease. Because I had a bunch of people running around behind me who were sicker than hell. Fortunately, nobody gave them a gun or they'd have killed half of Louisville. Same way with me. There was no fitting. It was the disease. To fit ourselves to be of maximum service. Laid the gun down. The terror came back. Called a good friend of mine who's a psychiatrist. He sent me to Payne Whitney Clinic in New York, where it took him about almost 10 days to detox me. Liver on my iliac crest. My eyes were yellow. I had a belly on me bigger than I got now. I had a balloon belly. I had an alcohol belly. And I had little bitty legs and little bitty arms. I mean, I was really sick physically. Took them almost 2 weeks to detox me. Then they sent me to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta. I spent 4 months there. I came home to Louisville in 1978. I came into Louisville when it was the best of times and the worst of times for AA. It was the best of times for AA because the fellowship was indescribably wonderful. We had 6 of us guys who ran together. I called us the little pygmy elephants. We hold each other's tail and we do like that. If the first one stops, everybody else got a brown nose. I mean, that's exactly what we... And honest to God, we ran that way. Our wives ran with us. It wasn't come 30 minutes early and stay 30 minutes late. We lived at 24/7. On weekends, we all cooked out together. Every one of us is still sober. All of us had the same sponsor. And that same sponsor was buried yesterday. Now, it wasn't the same sponsor I've had for the last 17 years, but it was one I had for the first 10 years. And let me tell you, if you really want this program that we've got, you will have a sponsor. And the evolution of what each of the sponsors, I've never been without one, I've had 3. And they were vastly different because my needs were different and God gave me what I needed. And that first sponsor was one crazy son of a bitch. I mean, there is no other way around it, but he was my crazy son of a bitch. I'll tell you that. And that man, if he said squat, I said, is there an X on the ground? Because I'll squat. I became absolutely obedient to this man and he raised me. He was 20 years older than me. He was 6'5", weighed 230. And in that fellowship program we had, when my mother died, when I was 8 months sober, I called Jim and he came out, sat in my leather chair in my inner office. I came in with my white coat and stethoscope on and crawled up in his lap. And he rocked me. He will always be one of God's great gifts to me. He didn't teach me the book. He did teach me the fellowship and he taught me obedience. I'm little, I'm loud, and I'm fast, and I'm scared. So I was deadly. And each day I had at least 40 to 60 people telling me I was the greatest thing since sliced bread. With the patients, the nurses, the whole deal. That's what doctors are. We live up here, whether you like it or not. We lived up here. They start teaching us that our junior year in medical school. We buy that shit about our senior year in medical school. That we live on a different plane. And I had at least 40 to 60 people every day telling me how wonderful I was. If not directly, it was implied. And my sponsor never called me. He called me, hey, you. I went to AA meetings in Louisville for 5 years where when I walked into the room, someone would say, Dr. Brady, can we talk to you after the meeting? Dr. Brady. What an incredible gift this man was. He didn't tell me to read the book and he didn't tell me to do the steps. So my experience will be to show you the second unique thing that I had. For the marching order in Louisville at that time was don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, and he'll tell you what to do. Didn't talk about that muddled middle where we clean up the wreckage of the past. I became a lethal weapon for God. I was all over Louisville. They said, here he comes, drink a beer because he's going to put you in treatment anyway. I'll tell you, in that first 6 months, let me tell you how this fellowship deal paid off and how that relationship with that sponsor paid off. You know, there's a thing called the post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Wilson described it in his story. For a year and a half, he couldn't get a job because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. In 1979, it was published by the medical people that there's a post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Short-term memory screwed up for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem-solving, stress management, sleep patterns screwed up. I used to lose my car in my parking lot. There's only 9 places in the damn parking lot. I would lose my car repeatedly. I'd pick up my meditation book and I'd read it. I'd think, that's beautiful. And I'd lay it down. I couldn't remember it. Pick up the paper and read it and couldn't remember it. And if you think you've destroyed your brain, if you can find this room, you're going to be okay. Let me promise you, you're going to be okay. There is a wet brain syndrome, but they can't find the room. And even if you had to have somebody come pick you up and bring you down here, the fact that you could follow them and recognize them when they picked you up, you're going to be okay. Now, I could practice medicine, but I was lethal going to the bathroom by myself. Yeah. And during that time, I would come in and I'd be examining a patient. I was fine. I knew how to do that. Then I'd walk out to walk to the next exam room. I'd just sit there and start shaking. I didn't know what was wrong with me. Oh, God, and I'd run in my inner office and I'd call Jim. I'd say, Jim, I'm flying apart. Did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Yeah. Seeing your patients on time? Yeah. You going to eat your lunch? Yeah. You coming to meet tonight? Yeah. You'll be fine. Thanks, Jim. Felt better. 30 minutes later, hour later, Jim, I'm flying apart. Get up on time. Yeah. I might call that man 4, 5, 6 times a day for damn near 6 or 8 months. So you see the miracle that was in me because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I remember I saw a psychiatrist. And I'd go and see him on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Homer was as good as we had then. I'd sit down on Tuesday and I'd work with Homer and I'd come back on Thursday. Where are we going to go, Homer? I want you to start where you were on Tuesday. I don't remember where we were on Tuesday. Well, you're blocking your therapy. Oh, God, I'm blocking my therapy. I'm a worm, you know? And then I'd go into a meeting and back, I got a problem. What's your problem? I'm blocking my therapy. Well, tell us about it, son. Well, I couldn't remember where we were on Tuesday. And one of the old timers said, you remember where his office is? I said, yeah, that's as good as it's going to get for 2 years. So just don't worry about it. You know? Oh, God. So that's the way I did for the first 10 years. Casey, at the end of 6 years, Casey, who's in Al-Anon, heard her story in a 12-step meeting, came back, crawled up with me on the couch, said, "I want to go back to school. I want to go to my own meetings." Casey and I had a unique relationship. I basically held her hostage, but she enjoyed it. I mean, I put her right here on my hip, and I wanted her to have the finest clothes I could buy. And every season, I'd have them shipped to her. Didn't ask her what she wanted. Wanted to have a new car every other year, and said, had it delivered. Didn't ask her what she wanted. Wanted to have fine vacations, took her on fine vacations, didn't ask her where she wanted to go. We had wonderful sex, I know, because we did everything I wanted to do, you know? And finally she comes back and she sits down and she told me these things she wanted to do. And I said, honey, that's wonderful. What? I won't need everybody to hear this. What I didn't know was it pissed me off. And it pissed me off because she broke the script. We're supposed to have this relationship where you get right here and you do what I tell you to do and we will be ecstatically happy. You're supposed to take care of me and make me feel special. I'll give you everything you need, but you have to take care of me and make me feel special. Right out of mama. That ain't Freudian. That's fact in this drunk. It took about 3 years and I had an affair. 10 years sober. When I listen to speakers talking, be honest, the insanity is never over because that's the deal of living in the real world on the real world's terms when we don't fit and we're not playing with a full deck. And that chemistry abnormality is what has to do with emotional stability. You couple that with the learned behavior, it gets really crazy. Now, after about 3 months of this, because who do I have an affair with? My nurse. What do nurses do? They take care of doctors and make them feel special. The young nurses don't, but the old nurses bought that crap. Yeah, they take, right. And it was my office nurse, and she'd been with me for 2 years, was divorced, had two children. She's a beautiful woman, a lovely lady. Obviously sick as I was, so we had an affair for about 3 months. And I remember thinking, I'm lying. If I lie, I'm not going to be able to stay sober. Because I really believe this then, believe it then, believe it today. If you can't be honest, you can't get this program. If you're honest, you got a shot. So I went to Jim, and I said, Jim, I'm having an affair. And he said, don't do that anymore. And I said, okay. So I went home. By the time I got home, he'd called my wife and told her. When I'm working with the men at the healing place, I mean, I'm in this room with 140 men, and you can cut the testosterone with a toothpick, honest to God, but willingness. And I tell this story when we're going to work on the fourth step, and I said, now, what do you think I should have done? You should have shot the son of a bitch. That's what you ought to have done. Yeah. And I say, that's a normal reaction. Now let's go to where there is loving the unlovable, tolerating the intolerable, and forgiving the unforgivable. Let's go where this program can take us. Now I learned a lot about that. First of all, I learned that sponsors aren't God. And anybody who makes a sponsor a God is absolutely destined to get crazy. Now, the real hooker in that, very early in the program, it's difficult to know the fly manure from the pepper, so you'll probably make that individual look like God. But you heard it here. Don't let a sponsor be God. We walk on water if we know where the stumps are, and we're doing the best we can do. But I tell anybody I'm sponsored, man, you expect me to walk on water, you are in Hurt City. I'll give you everything I've got, but on some days you may have to come get me and take me to my sponsor. I would never be without one, but sponsors are not God. And I told you what I think of Jim. I adore him. But from that time on, we never spoke. And it didn't have to do with me. Because by that time, what came up, I thought, I don't know what to do. There's nobody here to take care of me. I really said that. And I said, God, please help me. And a little sponsee of mine came up with 8 tapes in his hand, said, would you listen to these and see if they're any good? And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, I knew the program that I never knew existed. 12 of us got together with those tapes and our big book, and we sat down, and for a year, we went through and did our work together. We did the first big book study in Louisville, Kentucky, the second one that's ever done. Now there's 35 or 40 that grew out of that meeting. And we're not talking about mental masturbation big book studies. We're talking about people getting in there with their sponsors, doing their work. I do 2 big book studies a week and have for 17 years. Because when I found the truth of how to live with a 12-step program as compared to how to live with a desire not to drink in a 3 and 3rd-step program, I said, God, why'd you leave my ass out here? And I felt him say, son, I said, you may impress a lot of people with your knowledge, but you'll help heal a lot of people with your experience. And I loved you enough to give you this experience, and don't you ever fail to tell it to somebody. Tell them where the owner's manual is. Tell them where highway to spirituality is. Tell them the experience, because I gave it to you. Somebody said, how do you know? My God, I know. This ain't something we talk about. I'll just tell you what it means to me. You don't have to buy it, but I know. And again, the ball game was on. What an incredible way to live with 12 steps, and what a miserable way to live with 3 and 3rd-step. If you're in this room, you got the first 3 steps. Recovery will be continuing to evolve that as it progresses. You know you're powerless. You know your life's unmanageable. Take a power greater than you. You turn your life and you roll over. For at least 1 hour, you're going to sit in this room with the first 3 steps in your lap. First thing I learned is that my problem is not alcohol. What I subsequently learned is alcohol was my solution. My problem was my thinking. And Wilson called it the peculiar mental twist. That's exactly what he calls it. Read a chapter more about alcoholism. He called it the peculiar mental twist. It's the thinking that starts here to get to here and taking a drink. But it's that thinking I alluded to earlier. He never really describes it in detail except in Jim's story. If you read Jim's story, you can see the progression of the peculiar mental twist, the thinking that an alcoholic does to get to the drink. The drink may occur on Saturday night, but the relapse started 6 months ago with a compromise of the truth and a compromise of the principles. It in me, I didn't have to drink, I just got nuts. Let me tell you what the peculiar mental twist means to me. First of all, bigger than the rules. We got rules. Silkworth said, if these men follow a few simple rules, we've got rules. And for me, I get in trouble when I begin to think I'm bigger than the rules. Not just in the program, but out in society. I got 9 points on my driver's license. I was thinking one night, wonder why I have 9 points on my driver's license. Well, you drive too damn fast. That's right, I drive too damn fast. Wonder why I drive too damn fast. I don't understand. Maybe I'm crazy. No, you got all kinds of discharge summary says you're not crazy. Well, maybe I'm stupid. No, you got all kinds of degrees that says you're not stupid. Then why do I drive too fast? Because you're Burns Brady. You're Burns Brady. You live bigger than the rules. Handicapped parking zones. Yeah, I'm just going to be in the post office 15 minutes. Park right there. Are you handicapped, son? But I'm only going to be here 15 minutes. Same ticket. You still got it. Don't do it anymore. But by God, I'll circle the block 8 or 10 times trying to avoid parking in those handicapped. I'll do it today. Here's a parking spot down here, and I circle the block 8 times so I don't park here. Don't even see that place over there. And one day I started laughing. I thought, well, you myopic son of a bitch, I don't think you could find a commode in the dark, you know? Or if I did, it said women's restroom, I'd go in there just because I'm Burns Brady, you know? Bigger than rules. Wilson called that self-centeredness. The other one is victimization. Mickey, you're my problem. You gave a great talk yesterday and threatened me and intimidated me so much I wasn't even going to show up this morning. You're my problem. If you weren't here, I'd be all right. You know that kind of stuff? I mean, Bob and Clint did fine, but you were special, so I can compete with them, but I can't compete with you. You understand what I'm talking about? Somebody is my problem. You know, the IRS is out to screw me. This thing had feedback in it, so James didn't do his damn job. You know, I got the whole litany of things that I can go through. I talked in an Al-Anon meeting in 5, 6 years ago. It was one of those deals where you come in. I was the token AA speaker on Saturday morning, and I came in and met all the drunks. We went down to this little buffet, and they pulled the stuff out and put it up, our plates and all of our setups, and you can go through the buffet with your plate. I went through first, came back and sat down. All my setups were gone. I thought, God, I'm going to get... But I said in my most spiritual voice, ma'am, you did it. I walked 2 steps, and I'd sit down at the wrong table. You understand? But my first thought was, she screwed me. You know? You know, victims may not drink, they just don't get sober. You know? And we've seen a lot of victims in AA. We see them all the time. We're in the real world. Wilson called that self-centeredness. He called it resentment and self-pity. Final one is square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If the square peg doesn't fit in the round hole, just get me a damn hammer and get it down on the floor and just stomp the hell out of it, you know, but make it fit. Now, what's that all about? Life being unmanageable? Yeah. Let me tell you, it's the fear of not being able to run my own life. Those of us who drink again in this room, we won't drink because we don't buy the first half of the first step. We will drink because we don't buy the second half of the first step. Every one of my problems is a first step problem. And every one of my solutions is a 12-step solution. It ain't the 4th and 5th step. It ain't the 8th and 9th step. It ain't the 6th and 7th. It's 12 steps to deal with a first step problem. Look at listening meetings. Think about yourself. The whole conflict comes because I can't manage the world. I've got to make it do this, that, whatever the reason. And the solution to the 12. Sit in a meeting and somebody says, no, you got to do a 4-step. No, you don't. You got to do 12 steps. You got to do 12 steps. Now, you say, is he preaching? You're damn right. Real close to it. And the reason is because that's my experience. A 12-step solution for a first-step problem. Solution spiritual. Let me take the smoke, mirrors, and magic out of it for you. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It doesn't say a spiritual awakening is the result of having a sponsor. It doesn't say having a spiritual awakening is the result of going to meetings. It says having a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. Now, when that happened for me, I was able to appreciate in depth the spiritual experience of going to meetings, of having a sponsor, of being obedient, of doing all the directions that you gave me. But I just took those things for granted. Miracles have been swirling around me all my life, but I didn't see them. And when I had a spiritual awakening, my God, I saw them everywhere. Somebody asked Wilson, what part of this program is spiritual? He said, it is spiritual. Well, what's spirituality, Bill? Humility and responsibility. Humility and responsibility. First three steps, absolutely etched in stone. The humility of a power greater than me and my limitations. And the last nine steps is to do the work. To do the work to get the spiritual awakening. I had a teacher in high school who used to say the greatest gift God ever gave the people was the gift of work. Now I used to think, damn, Ms. Wyman, I don't get that. Well, boy, today I do. Today I do. About 10 years ago, I started studying Bill Wilson. I became fascinated with Bill Wilson. I still am fascinated with him. I'm not just so fascinated so much with the person anymore, but I'm fascinated with the whole series of events that tapped him and brought him into a place to do something. I'm fascinated with the fact he was so flawed. If you ever study the Bible enough, and I will tell you I've studied enough to have a pretty good insight into it, when God picked people to change things, he picked the people who were flawed. With the exception of Jesus, if you study Jesus enough, and this is very much a personal feeling, I do not believe Jesus had his attraction because he was perfect. If you think he's perfect, think about Gethsemane. How long did he spend in Gethsemane trying to deal with the devil about whether he wanted to go this way or that way? If he had been the perfect person, he wouldn't have had to debate it on it. What was the going price for the devil at that time? Three whores and a donkey? I don't know what it was, but Jesus was sitting there working with this concept, and he wasn't sure. That's when Jesus became alive to me, because of that. And I looked at all the imperfections of Abraham. You go down through the deal, David and Bill. What brought him viable to us was his woundedness. We are in God's army, and our woundedness is what gives us our value. It's the only army where the wounded soldiers serve on the front lines, because that's our power. That is our power. That's our gift. You heard Bob talking about the gift, and that's the gift. But I began to study Wilson. And finally, about 5 years ago, I thought, man, I don't know of anybody who loves this program and who really goes at this program like me, but there's just a feeling in me, and I don't understand what it is. So Casey, my sponsor, my psychiatrist, went in and sat down, and my therapist, I got a whole army running around down there. We went in there and sat down, and I said, and they said, Burns, just step off on the shore. And I said, I'm trying. God, I'm trying. I don't know. And they looked at me and said, do you know anything about miracles? I said, damn little. I just know this circle deal. And they said, why don't you start looking for the miracle in the ordinary? I thought, oh, okay. So I began to, in a meeting, I would see something like yesterday. And I'm saying, if Bob referred to it, the miracle. We see miracles every day, every night in AA to the point they almost become non-existent as a miracle. But practicing medicine for 25 years and doing this deal for 27 years, I got to tell you, we are loaded with miracles. If I knew each of you individually, you would be a miracle. And I began to see that. And I started getting this peace. Casey and I were in... some of you may not like this. Some of you may laugh. Some of you may think it's crude, but it's the truth. Casey and I were in England 5 years ago, right after that. And I started having a lot of belly aches as we were at the airport getting ready to leave. And I thought, God, please help me. Casey's diabetic, insulin dependent. I said, we're going to be fighting this deal for 24 hours. Please help me. My belly's hurting me. I'm tired. I've got to take care of her. Please help me. And I knew I had to go to the bathroom and have a bowel movement. So I walked in there and sat down and had this incredible bowel movement. I mean, it was just a bowel movement for the ages, you know? And as I come out, I'm walking across the airport, and I'm saying, I'm not hurting. I feel good. No problem. I said, God, thank you for that bowel movement. And I come home, and I tell it to my home group, and now they call it Burns Brady's holy shit. But it's a true story. I remember walking around, I thought, my God, I'm thanking God for a bowel movement. And it felt wonderful. I mean, it's like I had it, but you caused it, you know, that kind of thing. Then about three years ago, I realized I had known happiness, I have known joy, I still do, but I had virtually never known peace. That motor that goes like it. I mean, moving just like that. I'm there before I even think about leaving here. You know, that kind of deal. The motor just, hell yes, you know it. I heard you. Motor just runs. I thought, God, I don't know why I don't know peace. And I thought, wonder. So I began to study Wilson again because I thought there's an answer here somewhere. And I got to the story of Ed Dowling. Many of you know Ed Dowling by history, and Ed Dowling was a Jesuit priest who saw Bill Wilson in 1940, and for 20 years, hadn't been for Dowling, I'm not sure where AA would be. Because he was Wilson, he called him his sponsor, but I just called him his spiritual mentor. In 1940, the story is beautiful. Dowling comes up to see Wilson. He's read the book, 12 Steps are the Ignatian Spiritual Exercises Reduced to 12 Steps. And Dowling is coming up to meet this man who had done this thing that he just astounded him. It's November 1940. Night is cold. Wilson's in that first little clubhouse. And the keeper's there with him that took care of the clubhouse. Lois is gone. Nobody's told us where she was. Caretaker comes up and knocks on the door and said, Bill, there's someone here to see you. It's 10 o'clock at night. And he thought, oh, God, no, not another alcoholic. You know, about the third day you're doing a fifth step with somebody, you think, oh, God, have I got to go sit through that thing again? But we always do because somebody did it with us. So bring Dowling up, and he can hear Dowling's cane tapping on the floor. Dowling was about 5'6". His picture's in the archives, little round Pugsy face, and they called him Pugsy in white shocky hair. And he can hear the canes tapping on the floor because Dowling had a lot of spinal arthritis. Dowling comes into the room. Wilson's about 6'4". Dowling's about 5'6". And I can just see the scene. Dowling had on an overcoat. Wilson asked him to take it off. He did, and he saw his collar. Wilson loved men of the cloth. And I know because I felt the same way and still do at times. What is it that they've got that I didn't have? Today I know I've got it, so now I just admire them. But Wilson began to talk with Dowling about this. Finally, he said, will I ever know peace? Dowling said, no. He said, why? He said, you've been blessed with divine dissatisfaction. He said, in your seeking, so many people will be brought to the light. And I sat back and just started bawling because I knew. Then I began to look for the miracle in the ordinary along with this divine dissatisfaction and realized when I did know peace was sitting there talking to a young alcoholic whose eyes are just, you know what we look like. And I'm talking, he's talking, we're talking, and then he realizes that I know. Then I know peace. You know it. Then I know peace. And that's good enough. Mama died in 78. I made my amends. 8 months sober. Daddy died in 92. He married one of his best friends about a year later. And praise God he did because he began to lose his mind. I would go down and try to make my amends to my daddy. He'd say, Burns Mac, I don't want to talk about it. He is truly one of the finest human beings I ever knew. He never said much. Daddy just always appeared when I needed him. He would just appear. I wanted his approval more than anything on earth. Peggy, my stepmother, said, the reason your daddy wouldn't talk to you, Burns Mac, because he was so ashamed. I said, of me? And she said, no, of himself. He thought he had failed you. But I wanted him to tell me it's okay. I worked with thousands, literally thousands of men, and I know for sure what. I've held men in my lap that big. Big as Randy is. And I mean literally as big as Randy is and could eat that wall. And they're sitting in my lap while I rub the back of their head and tell them it's okay. They just told me stuff they've never told anybody else. And I say it's okay. And they know they're home. And that's what I wanted from Daddy, and it wasn't going to happen, because in addition to his shame, then he began to lose his mind like Alzheimer's, dementia. And Peggy and I finally had to put him in a nursing home. And I was driving down. I was about 16 years sober. And this miracle was happening. Casey and I, my men's to Casey, my men's to Kathy. Our 12-step programs in that solution with the therapist. And everything was happening to me. And when I'd go down to see Daddy, I'd drive along. I'd say, God, take away my pain. And when I got there, the pain never left. That day I drove in and parked the car. And I sat there and I said, God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. I don't know where it came from. I do know, but I didn't know then. I walked in, Daddy's in a wheelchair. I go over and I say, Hal didn't call him Daddy, that confused him. I said, can I help you? He said, yeah, Buster. He thought I was his brother. He said, would you shave me? And I shaved Daddy. Would you like some lunch? I believe I would. And I went out and fed him. He's too weak to feed himself. Peggy came in, sat there and got to talking, me and Peggy. Daddy was sitting in his wheelchair watching us. Not say anything. I rolled him out on the porch. We sat there and Peggy and I got to talking. Daddy's in the wheelchair watching us. Daddy raised up in his wheelchair and looked at me and he said, Burns Mac, today you're just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. The miracle was not that my daddy recognized me, because actually I can explain that medically. But for the first time, I'm able today to explain to you the miracle of what happened in this alcoholic's life. Instead of take away my pain, it was let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That is Alcoholics Anonymous as I know it, as I live it, with God's grace and your love and God's love. I appreciate you letting me come. It's been a wonderful experience for me. Godspeed. Thank you.